Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
Hello, ahoy, and welcome to Always There, the Howard's Way podcast. I'm Julia Rayside. Thank you for joining me as I navigate through every single episode of the 1980s seafaring soap opera set in the fictional English coastal town of Tarrant. It would be a lonely voyage without you. And joining me today to discuss Series 3, Episode 4 is the actor and writer John Dryden Taylor.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm as well as can be expected, as well as which can I be think expected. Is the best answer one can give under the circumstances.
Very good, very good. Then I think we should go straight away to Tarrant.
Yeah, well, last time I was there, now this is my third time on the Always There poop deck, and I do try not to have any interaction with Howard's Way between episodes that I record. It's surprisingly easy to do.
It's a method thing with you, isn't it? You really focus on
But genuinely, when I listen to other episodes of this podcast, I try and sort of tune in for the jokes and tune out for the plot, because when I come to a new episode, I want to sort of be able to gauge myself about where I was before. So last time I was here, Series 2, Episode 1, there was a whole sort of Elizabeth is Missing prequel going on with regard to Lynn.
Yes.
Where Jan was wandering around Tarrant going, yeah, my daughter's definitely missing. And everyone's sort of saying, oh, she's probably just got distracted looking at pictures of chocolate. She'll be back soon. And in fact, you told me that Lynn was lying under Charles Frere's boat.
Yeah, she was. She was floating, probably face down, I imagine, just sort of bobbing around. But the nurse said up to 10 minutes, but then she miraculously survived.
But nobody cared is the thing. I mean, even Jan, who was the only worried person, if you remember, we noticed that she'd somehow had a chance to change clothes and drink a bottle of wine.
Yes, but she was worried, John. That's what she does. She relies on fashion and alcohol to get her through. That was authentic and entirely in character. So this series, you may have noticed, there's no Lynn. She's not missing.
Yeah.
They know where she is. She's in Portugal. And as they keep saying once every episode, when I've had a phone call from Lynn, apparently she's fine. That's all they ever say about her.
This is the brilliant thing, is that coast through the fact that the title say we're going to get Michael Denison, which I'm incredibly excited about. I got punked by Howard's Way in this episode, because I wrote something down while I was watching the title saying, this is so misleading because it's all open sea and at one with nature, and then it's loads of 80s drab interiors when you get into the show. But this episode starts with actual boating. But as you say, it's boating in which the only thing that happens in the scene is Tom and Leo have a, so I hear Lynn's still all right. Yup. And then that's the end of the scene. I feel very seen as an LGBTQ person by the pride wind cheaters they're both wearing.
It's a nice touch, isn't it? It's a nice touch.
I don't think it was intentional.
I think it's the Howard family matching sailing gear. I think they all have, apart from Jan, obviously, they all have this matching rainbow trimmed stuff.
Well, I mean, it's a very queer show. In every possible interpretation.
Well, you say that, but this episode is getting to grips with, without mentioning it, something rather gritty 80s and LGBTQ, etc.
Hoo boy.
Okay, so let's begin. As you mentioned, at sea, Tom and Leo, they have discerned from a letter that she's getting on all right. That's Lynn in Portugal.
I can't stress enough how nothing else happens in that scene. Sailing, sailing, sailing. Oh, by the way, Lynn. Yeah, she is. Cool. End of scene.
And there's so much going on in both of their lives. Like, Leo's mystified by this weird new woman who won't stop sex pesting him, and Tom's life has fallen apart. He's living in a paint shed, but they just don't talk about it. They just both look quite glum.
I mean, I don't find out in my not having been here since series 2, episode 1 kind of way. I don't find out about Tom until the next scene where Avril sort of kicks off the scene with a "Hello, I am a clever business lady" speech, which has been written by somebody who has never worked in an office. So Avril here has her clever business lady speech, and then there's something about if Tom Howard is cleared. So fill me in.
So what happened
Craig
was...
David's girlfriend's father
I'm not doing that, John, as well you know. Tom designed a catamaran, which was tested by a couple who... It wasn't quite clear. I think they were thinking about buying it, and the catamaran sank, killing one of said couple.
Oh, so this is the Travises.
Right? Yes, the Travises. So Mrs. Travis's solicitor is conducting a kind of an... Well, there's been an inquest. It was... And then now there's an inquiry to see who was at fault. Like, why did the thing sink? And Tom can't get his hands on the wreckage because they've kind of commandeered it, so he can't prove his innocence.
There's a corker of a plan brewing for how he's going to prove his innocence, which we'll get to later.
Oh, yes. But back in the Relton boardroom, my favourite bit was Colin, who I don't think we've met before, Colin torpedoing Avril by citing her personal feelings for Tom Howard as a reason why she still has faith in him as a designer. And she didn't like that, and she said, "I'm going to have to ask you to retract that, Colin."
Yeah, shady, huh? Also, there was a, for connoisseurs of Barracuda, there was a brilliant one in this scene. It had about 6 or 7 extra syllables between the A and the U. Also, another great line in that scene where the priorities of this series being so different from most human people's priorities, it's very important how you look to the marine industry, which is how I, you know, that's how I get dressed in the morning. I hold up various clothes in a montage and say, "What would the marine industry think of this?"
And the answer is, it's always Nautique is best.
And there's mad pencil and pen and pencil work.
Oh, yes, so, Charles and his golden ballpoint that he also uses to bid with at auctions.
Yeah, and Avril just whirling hers round and round and round and round to show tension.
Yeah, that's some tension acting right there. Lots of pen acting.
There's the 80s solution to everything, which is if you need to get somebody on side, get them to present something or open a supermarket.
That's it. So she tells Charles that he's going to present a cup at a speedboat race, which has got a top prize of £10,000. But obviously they're entering a boat. There's a speedboat company who were going to have their boat distributed by Relton Marine, who ended up going with Ken Masters and Leisure Cruise. So Avril's kind of in the drink about that with Charles because she lost a client, basically. But now she's found another speedboat client to kind of fill that gap. So they're going to enter their own speedboat in the race. So they're obviously hoping it will be a win for Relton and they can, you know.
Yeah, there's a whole speedboat race plot in this episode. And I'm not going to lie, I didn't have a clue what was going on at any time.
But well, I've written
some facetious things about them.
Oh,
so
good, I'm glad.
Don't worry, we'll be fine.
I can fill you in on anything you need to know, trust me. So then we go to the yard, where once again a scene at the yard starts with a close-up of a calculator indicating they have money worries.
Well, I mean, your husband's brilliant point about the clink, clink, clink that needs to be in so much narrative drama on telly, which is the pressure of money.
Yes, because it's in all of our lives and people on TV have massive flats and no debts, and then there's not enough of it.
So I say hurrah for the calculator close-up. I also say hurrah for the 30 Rock plotline, because this is, we've got to lay off a certain number of staff. And I just wanted Jenna Maroney to come in and start pointing at people.
Well, Tom Howard has also already laid off his own son. He was like, "Sorry, son, last in, first out," and just sacks him completely without affection.
I also got very confused in this scene because in the first episode I watched, which was halfway through series one, I got confused about Jack talking about toy boats, because he meant that any boat that wasn't made of wood might as well be a toy.
Yes, a plastic
toy. So imagine my consternation in this episode when Jack moves from one room to another and there's a toy boat.
There are real toy boats. Not the only one. There's a toy catamaran. There's a toy one. There's quite a few. They've clearly had a budget for models this series they didn't previously have, because models are in every episode this series so far.
Hallelujah, Leo arrives.
Hooray!
And I wrote, "What decade is it, Leo's sunglasses?"
I think he looks smashing. He gets topless later as well, so they're clearly going for like the whole sex symbol thing with him.
Talk about bait and switch. That's total false advertising. I'm like, hot dude near boat. Oh, great, it's Leo.
Oh, no. I'm sorry we disappointed you. But no, Jack and Bill are talking about who they're going to sack. And they get this guy called Bernie keeps coming up. Bernie, but he's got 3 kids and another one on the way. So he gets mentioned mentioned more than once this episode. Obviously, we will never meet Bernie. Bernie doesn't exist. But Jack is wondering if he can squeeze Avril to try and use her influence on Charles Frere to get the boatyard making money again, because basically they can't make any money at the moment.
This is the entire theme of this episode. This entire episode is women, hey? They'll do anything to get what they want from men. All three plots.
Yeah, they'll manipulate them and flirt with them and go, oh, I will go for dinner with you.
Dinner, but just consecutive meals. We'll come to that in a minute.
Oh, yeah, no, the meals are endless. They literally do not end. The restaurants of Tarrant are just never empty. Then we go to the marina, and that's probably where you mentioned, yes, Leo is trying to cheer his dad up, but Tom is in the depths of self-pity. His reputation's in tatters. He's drinking a bottle of whiskey every 3 minutes. He lives in a paint shed. He can't even afford a room in the pub anymore. His eye bags are like, you know, off all known charts. He's in a bad way.
It was just the sunglasses for me. I mean, I tune out when Leo's around anyway.
Aww.
But I literally just clocked the sunglasses and then I thought, well, time to move on. And when we do move on, my goodness, what a set. So Ken's working for Virgin Atlantic now, is that right?
Yes, yes, the red, grey and black colour scheme.
Everything is red.
It reminded me, I often say, of my brother's teenage bedroom, which was red, grey and black with sort of matching black ash furniture.
And here's Ken Masters, though, in order just to cheer us all up. And he's so cool. Now that we're in series three, he's almost completely dispensed with consonants because the coolest people.
He's become, I feel like his balls are getting bigger as the show goes on, as his success begins to grow. And when he's got another man to alpha it over, then he just becomes almost insufferably laid
back. I had to call this guy Ekru Leisurewear because obviously I'd never met him before. I didn't know who he was. By the end of the episode, I'd figured out that he is the husband of Ken's current squeeze.
That's
correct?
The one. Yes, the one with the giant horns on his head. Mark Cuckold Foster. That's his name. So there's a scene between, whenever there's a scene between him and Ken, they're always sort of butting heads and trying to see who's got the biggest willy. But I like the way this scene starts. It starts with Mark unfurling a poster that says powerboat race prize £10,000 with a picture of a powerboat. It's like, keep it simple, very, the camera won't be on it for long.
It's very, very penultimate frame of the Beano, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
What am I going to do to buy all these cakes? And then there's a big sign that just eat as many cakes as you want to win more cakes.
Exactly.
It feels a bit like that.
So, but I like also, while Mark is looking at that poster, he turns to go up the stairs to show it to Sarah and Ken. And Ken, when you cut to them, he's just staring at Sarah's bum while she's bending over the photocopier. It's like, oh, mate. I mean, you'd expect nothing more or less from Ken. They're trying to decide who's going to race the leisure cruise boat in
drive the boat.
Yeah, that's it. Now, I've said that before and felt foolish, like I probably got something wrong, but apparently the speedboat, you can drive it, not pilot it. Yeah. I don't know. Someone will write in and say.
So at this point, Ken Masters and a man who I only know at this point as
Ekru Leisurewear,
are bumping heads over who gets to drive a boat. And then there's a sort of ill-defined bet. If one of us wins, then a good thing will happen to that person.
Uh-huh. Kind of a bet. I think they get to represent the leisure cruise team for the rest of the season, John.
It's probably that. Yeah. But all I care about is if Ken Masters is here, can Jan Howard be far behind? And no, she's not, with the best entrance line anyone's had.
Go on.
In any episode, purely because of the way people spoke in the 80s on television, where they don't now. Jan is talking about the posthumous success of the fashionista Claude. And the first thing we hear is her saying, it was the final irony. I played it back. I think it's definitely supposed to be irony, but what we hear is, it was the final irony. It's an extraordinary collection of syllables.
Right, sack the sound man, because they're making the goddess that is Jan sound like she can't pronounce the word irony.
No, sack the 80s. Arrest the 80s. Send it to prison for stupid pronunciation.
Fair enough.
Now, Jan's in mauve, which throws the colour coding all off whack.
It does.
Because as we know, when Jan's in white, she's mother, nurturer, carer. Yeah. When she's in blue, she's I'm a sex lady for my boutique.
Yes.
What does mauve mean?
I don't know, because it wasn't my first choice for like a colour that suggests power and business acumen. Like I'd have said something like slate grey, or I don't know, something a bit more masculine. It's very floaty and feminine what she's wearing. But I guess she wants to represent fashion to these old fuddy-duddies who don't know.
Which, as we know, is a waste of time, because one of them has basically a line, which is, we're old crusty white men. We can't possibly understand dresses. So show us where either your money or your vagina is and we'll consider it.
That is the subtext of the scene in a nutshell, John. So Jan is before the board of Edward Freer's new local enterprise initiative. He could give her up to £250,000, we're told. So she's gone there in her lilac finery to go and sort of sweet talk these old buffers. And at one point, Sir Edward, when he looks at her ambitious plans for expansion, says, "You want to open a chain of boutiques?" Like, she's already got one. Like, she could probably have another few.
Have a look in the appendix, Edward. The cash flow's all there.
It is in the appendix. It is. Just use it.
And then they basically sort of say what they're trying to find out is she going to have lots of family requirements like women do?
Yeah.
But then they're like, oh, she's got no husband. Her kids are grown up. One of them's constantly missing. This woman is going to have all her time to devote to business and dinner and sex, which are the only things that
Sir Edward
women ever do.
Certainly, yes, no. But obviously, Sir Edward is clumsily trying to, one, establish he likes the look of her and he wants to know what's under the lilac folds, and two, that he wants to know if she's single, basically. It's a very clumsy way of saying, are you up for it?
And it's another one of these insane timelines, because it's dinner that night,
followed by breakfast, lunch and dinner the next day.
Well, he does, at the dinner, he invites her for lunch. It's like, do you want to spend all your time with me?
I've been on dates
maybe
like
just
that,
every
John.
Time you eat. But so yes, he invites Jan to dinner, and it's very clear that it's a sexing thing. And then to complete my holy trinity of Ken, Jan and Kate, the next scene brings us Dulcie Gray apparently thinking about knitting a big chunky necklace.
It's not made of gold, John. I can safely say that.
But she acts so suspiciously with it. And it was clearly just a, you know, we start on you with the necklace, have a look at it, put it down and then get it out of the way for the scene. But something goes awry between that direction and what actually ends up on screen. Because
maybe it's like the fifth take.
Shifty.
I know, it's like the fifth take. And she's like, what do I do with the bloody... Can we just get on with this? But I like Jack. So Jack is arriving to basically talk to his friend Kate. But I just wrote fish out of water because he does brilliant kind of... Oh, I'm in a shop full of ladies' things. I don't feel terribly comfortable, if I'm perfectly honest. And he sort of does that hands in pockets, like shoulder hunch thing, like, oh, ladies' frilly things, no thanks.
So he's now exploiting that friendship.
I mean, they are good pals, and he's sort of been there for her through her gambling addiction that she doesn't seem to have stopped yet, even though she's lost her house now.
And do we see a classic Howard's way, you can switch off for the next 30 seconds line? Yes, we do, because it's a wonderful introduction to exposition. She says to him, it's not as complicated as it sounds. And then launches into the sister's
exposition,
cousin of the owner of
I phoned so-and-so and she called so-and-so and sent a pigeon to what's it?
Absolutely unfollowable.
No, but it's script-wise not necessary at all.
But they've given us that hint, because when someone says it's not as complicated as it sounds, you know, you can go and put the kettle on.
Exactly.
And come back when the exposition's over.
In Too Long Didn't Read, there's an admiral what wants a boat. Turns out Kate sent him. She sort of hasn't seen him for a while, but she sent him along to the boatyard because she heard on the grapevine that he was looking for a boat. And she knows that her dear friend's boatyard is about to go under unless someone buys a boat from them. So, hence, ergo.
And Jack very creepily says, he said you were lovely. with a really creepy pause. As if we're in a serial killer movie.
No, it's really cute. It's like their kids are like, I think he likes you. And she's like, oh, well. she clearly has a past. But she agrees to try and have a word with Admiral Francis Redfern, as we now discover he's called. But she hasn't seen him for 30 years. But she says, sure. Judging by later in the episode, she finds out where he lives and agrees to go and have a word with him. Then, sexy, sexy saxophone.
Cool. Who's that? Oh, it's Leo. Now,
but it's also Amanda. I think the saxophone is for Amanda.
I hadn't met Amanda before. And there's a brilliant piece of what's supposed to be sexy back and forth dialogue, which I would slightly rewrite.
Okay.
Because Amanda says to Leo, I'm not used to chasing after men. And he says, they usually come after you, do they? Sorry, they usually chase after you, do they? And I want her to say, yes, that's what I meant.
Like, again, unnecessary. Yeah,
what did you think I was saying? When I say I'm not used to chasing men, I mean, like, why do you think I was saying it, Leo? But instead, she just tries to paint him with a roller instead.
She does. She threatens him with a loaded roller of blue paint and says, I want you to take me out to dinner in a way that you'd run into the sea rather than do it. She may be sexy, but she's clearly a murderer or worse. You know, she's mad. All of her days are spent just turning up and bugging him.
This is literally, by the way, what every man does to every woman in this series.
Yeah.
But because a woman's doing it to a man, suddenly it's sinister. Every man is like, hello, here's my cigar and some of my money. Come over here, Popsy. Whereas
Popsy.
And then suddenly Amanda gets, you know, Amanda throws Leo a
sexually
sort of
aggressive
flirty,
woman, it's not allowed.
A flirty bone that he fumbles and drops in the sea. And then she has to enroll him in the Blue Man group to get him to take any notice of her.
Oh, God. Let me tell you, John, it doesn't end well. She gets her moral comeuppance, don't you worry. Then we go to the Urquhart's house where Gerald...
I'd never met Gerald before. I'd never met him before. Oh. I'd only met the marmalade wig on a stick.
Yes, vinegar tits. Yes, her.
Who's now a mullet on a stick. She's growing it out.
She does a mullet and then she sticks a big bow at the back that's like twice the size of the head. So it's quite an interesting... It's an odd look. It's quite unbalanced.
They have a little bit of banter about how he's going to leave her, hilariously. It's like, let's play the leaving role play.
Yeah.
And then she very unsubtly says, she'll have to be very understanding, you massive homo. I mean, it's not subtle, this bit.
No, it's not subtle. But basically, yes, his bags are in the hallway. Preceding this, they've had big rows and Gerald has thrown a vase at a fireplace in disgust because she keeps spending... She's bored. He's not noticing her like he used to, even though he didn't used to notice her like that, let's be clear. But, you know, he's not around to play and take her to dinner and take her to the theatre anymore. So she's going out of her mind with boredom. So to get his attention, she starts spending all their money on stuff. And then he sort of goes crackers over the credit card bill and, you know, they have a massive row. And then it turns out his mind is actually on something completely different. A sad occurrence going on, I think in London, he receives a call from a doctor and you don't find out who, but it's like someone's not got long. And so he's definitely got something on his mind and she's tried to be sympathetic, but he just won't talk to her about it. So they're kind of in a bit of a bad place at the start of this episode.
And spending is clearly very important to Polly because at the end of the scene, when he leaves, she does the signal of tragedy, which is leaning on the back of the door. Somebody leaves a house and you lean on the back of the door when you're an extremist.
Exactly.
Polly's just been told to rein that spending in.
And he says, otherwise I really will leave you. Bye! I think he means it. Anyway, then we go to the Howard's house where Jan is dolled up in basically some shimmering silver fabric. She looks quite... I mean, she's glittering as she walks. And she's getting ready to go out for dinner.
Meanwhile, Kate is dressed as a beach hut.
She looked lovely.
She's in those yellow and white stripes. And Leo is in a blue cardigan, which was presumably a white cardigan before Amanda got her hands on it. We find out that he's dating Kate's ex's granddaughter, which feels a bit incesty.
Really incesty. But then that is Tarrant all over. Jan's going out to dinner with her daughter's ex-boyfriend, who nearly caused her death. The daughter's
father.
Husband, yeah, the father, you know what I mean. Yes, that. So, you know, it is all very incestuous. The whole town is like that. Leo's hounding his mum about who she's going out with and she won't say because she's clearly worried that Leo will be like, a frère? I don't think so. He'll be angry with
her. But then, again, the way people only behave in drama, she doesn't want them to find out who she's going to dinner with.
Yeah.
But then she says, I haven't finished my presentation. So basically she says, I'm not going to tell you who I'm going out to dinner with, but I am going to give you a massive clue
but
for
it
no
is Sir
reason,
Edward
if that's
Freer,
okay.
But shh, don't tell you. And then we go to Avril's, where she's scraping some chopped onions over some raw chicken in an unappetizing manner.
Now, A, I want to know what she's cooking.
Yeah.
B, that kitchen, that galley kitchen, it's like one of the flats they rent for a dinner date so that women aren't actually having strangers in their homes.
Yes, yes.
It's exactly that kind of feel of no one actually lives here. And then you think it's going to be a sort of grim little flat, but then they move out into an open space where there's a grand piano.
Yep.
And there's a statement staircase.
She's a managing director now, John, so she's moved to a kind of a waterside apartment.
May I ask you a question?
Yes.
I think Howard's Way is very good at foreshadowing. And in this scene, Avril says, well, not unless I lose my job. It feels like if you're shown a gun in Act 1, then it's going to go
very
off in
check
Act 4.
Off. No, in this case, I don't think that's on the cards yet. There's so much else that has to happen. No, I think in this case, that may just be bad writing. As it's leading you down a path which literally has nothing at the end of it. But, you know, get your hopes up if you want. It's like, there's no skin off my nose.
Anyway, I've got to put this raw chicken and raw onion in the oven.
Sure you won't stay for supper? No, thanks. I don't think the oven's even on, so it's not good. Bernie's mentioned again. Bernie's got three kids and another one on the way. So everyone knows who Bernie is. He's a really popular guy. Also, virile as fuck.
Yeah. Well, this is Tarrant. I mean, you eat dinner, you do business, you have sex.
Yeah.
And in the very, very next scene, there's something that surely must happen every night in Casper's or wherever they are, which is two people who used to be banging finding themselves in a restaurant with different people at the same time.
Yes, exactly, exactly. Because like that's the only place to eat unless you want to go to the slightly down at heel Italian, which they usually only go to for lunch because it's more of a lunch place than a dinner place. Do you know what I mean? Before we leave Avril's though, she does write her dad quite easily a £3,000 check to pay the workforce for the next month so he doesn't have to lay off Bernie and his four starving children.
Well, one on the way.
Well, you know what I mean. He'll be working down that boatyard before it's 6 months old. yes, then we go to fancy restaurant Casper's, where Sarah and Ken are weirdly holding hands and are not. Well, she's holding his hand and he's sort of not.
Yeah.
But she just keeps it there. It's like a claw. She just sort of keeps it on him while they're talking.
And the waiter looks very like an 80s football manager.
Oh, really?
He's got that sort of wire brush hair. He's sort of, usually nowadays, you know, if there's a waiter character, they'll be young and sexy. But this is like a 50-year-old wire brush headed Brian Clough looking motherfucker who is apparently doling out the vino in Casper's.
Maybe he's Casper, but he's just decided to slum it for the night. I don't know.
Here are two things that absolutely back up my theory that Leo may not be human.
Okay.
Firstly, he lets her eat all his food.
Now, wait a minute. Leo's not in Casper's. Oh, you fast forwarded. We haven't left Casper. John, we can't just leave Casper's.
No, but Leo's in there, isn't he?
Leo's in a cheap Italian restaurant that doesn't...
Oh, they're cutting between...
I mean, it may just be that they turn the camera around and that restaurant is the other side of the same room. But it's not supposed to be, John. That's not supposed to be what you think.
They're cutting between eateries. Sorry, I didn't put
my
scene change.
Different restaurant. Otherwise, he's in the same restaurant as his mum, which would be really weird because he's already like quite Freudianly jealous of her going out with other people that aren't his dad. So I don't know.
I see what's happened. It's Casper's Italian Casper's, isn't it? It's a Casper's sandwich.
So Sarah and Ken are having a brief conversation about their affair. She's feeling guilty. No, she's at one point, he's looking off into the distance. She says, "Penny for them." Oh, how many times has that line been used in everything?
I think Dawn said it to Ken in the first episode I watched.
Yes, almost certainly. And then they discuss the fact that Mark is out for the evening. And Ken even wonders, or she wonders, if he's doing it on purpose, like giving them space to have their affair, to incriminate themselves, which is prefiguring, frankly, judging by the last scene. Mm-hmm. And then Jan walks in with Sir Edward. Incessant piano music throughout, I've put. It's really like, it's not like gentle background piano. It's just like piercingly, proddingly annoying. And then Sarah observes that Ken might be jealous that Jan's there with somebody else.
Yeah, that's right. So as I was saying, he lets her eat all his food.
Yeah.
He's just sitting there taking chip after chip after chip from his basket. And also, he says, "You're rich, I don't like that."
Yes. Well, does it make him feel emasculated? Because frankly, I don't think there was a lot of it left to have removed from him.
Also,
really.
The chips had done that anyway. The white and blue is the wrong way round in this scene, so maybe it skipped a generation. So virginal Leo is in blue and sex lady Amanda.
She is a sex lady, yeah.
And he really should be wearing white because this is the scene, they didn't have the word then, but this is the scene where Leo cops to being an incel. They have this girlfriend talk and he basically says, "No woman has ever allowed me to touch her apart from my sad friend who ran away." And even she didn't.
Even her baby wasn't fathered by me because I can't. There's an odd thing to get to. He must be, 21, 22 now? I mean, it happens. It seems a man who's willing to stand around painting boats with his top off has yet to be touched by a woman or man or indeed anyone. I like when they're discussing their plans for the future and Amanda makes it clear repeatedly that she's just a crazy live in the moment kind of dude. And she says, "I don't even know what I'm going to do in the next hour." Because she's a crazy manic pixie dream girl. And then Leo recalls wistfully how he used to go out with someone really boring who was very serious all the time, but not really go out with her.
He starts with, "She was the exact opposite of you." And I thought, that sentence has to stop there.
Everything you're not.
She's everything you're not. And then it's like, don't make a list.
But it still feels like it's really weird because of his acting and the script. It feels like he just has no interest in being there, but yet somehow his body has forced him to come. He just doesn't really like her. She's an idiot. He's not keen on her at all. But he just keeps on agreeing to whatever she says because he just can't say no.
Yeah, also,
I'm not convinced of his motives.
Also, she's fine. She does, it's Janice in Friends syndrome, in this episode at least. Because my husband's always saying, whenever an episode of Friends with Janice is like, they're so awful to that nice woman.
They are awful to her.
Oh, she's enthusiastic and she laughs and she's pleased to see us. What a horror.
Yes.
And I'm prepared to believe that Amanda is, you know, Maleficent herself. But in this episode, she comes in, she tries to flirt with Leo. He goes, sorry, I'm too stupid to be flirted with. Then they go out for dinner and she says, so, have you had lots of girls before? And he said, no, there was one and she wasn't like you. And then later on in the episode, what happens later on happens.
Oh, hello you. My name's Tom Price.
Hello, I'm Dave Cribb.
You should come and join us. Every day we do a podcast called Cabin Fever, where we talk to loads of comedians who've had to cancel everything else in their lives, so they come on our podcast instead, don't they, Dave?
Yeah, it's an isolation podcast.
Dave, were you yawning at the start of that sentence then? Was it just a little yawn?
Yeah, it's basically the Great Big Owl isolation podcast. We'll have people on from all our podcasts, from your Rule of Threes, your Brian Rogers, your Musicals, your Bitchins. If you like any of our podcasts, if you like any of those people, chances are they'll be logging onto the Zoom call and just chatting, because let's face it, they got nothing else to do.
Also, there'll be a quiz on the bill. All right, see you soon. Lots of love.
Cabin FE83709. Oh, 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 that's our Twitter name.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I know. I'm sort of Team Amanda at this point.
Okay, well, I will just say that she has stolen a boat and forced him to be an accessory, and they were pulled over by the police. And...
accessory like a brooch?
yes, like a nice handbag.
She's just wearing Leo as a cameo to hold
I think ultimately
on.
She does want to make him into her next handbag, but like nothing more. She just wants a puppet to play with. Yes, now, so the humble restaurant, we leave them there. She's trying to convince him she can be serious too, but she really can't because she's just a crazy girl who might just suddenly, I don't know, steal a BMX and knock over a policeman. So we go back to Fancy Casper's where Jan and Sir Edward are chatting, and then she notices Ken and kind of the thunderclouds briefly pass across her face.
But before that, there's some pretty dodgy sexual politics.
Yes.
Because, I mean, Jan is magnificently uncommitted to this whole Edward Freer thing.
Yeah.
Both in this day and in the subsequent one that comes later in the episode.
Yeah.
Everything she's saying is, just don't touch me.
Yeah, really, I don't like you physically at all.
And she asks lots of, wait, is this a bad idea? Questions at the beginning of this day, including, do you take your male people who are applying for money out to dinner?
Yeah.
And he says, no, don't tell the sex equality people.
Yeah.
And they both laugh, and Jan laughs.
She has to. She needs the money.
Big lols. We find out that boats killed her marriage. Now, it's not great dialogue, this scene, but they're so classy, especially Jan Harvey. This is my Jan Harvey worship section that I always have in one of these episodes. She's so natural, and sometimes the dialogue isn't great, but she says stuff like it's just occurred to her, which is really, really hard to do with some of these lines. And I bow to her.
She could do it with Shakespeare, I bet. She's just brilliant.
Then then there's consecutive meals. We've just finished dinner. Come to lunch tomorrow.
But also, he's being so creepy. Like, he knows everything about her, who her husband used to work for. And there's a kind of exchange of, oh, you've been checking up on me. But seriously, at that point, I'd be like, okay, that's actually stalking. That's why I'm not okay with that.
I suppose in the 80s it is, because now you just read the Facebook and find out all this information. But I suppose you had to do a bit of work to get that information.
Oh, yeah.
They have a very weird unfinished line moment, because he's asked her to lunch and she's saying, oh, I don't think that's a good idea, blah, blah, blah. And then she says, well, in that case. And it's that usual 80s thing of, I'm going to say something rather mysterious. But she doesn't get a chance to say it because she clocks Ken.
Leaving with
Meanwhile,
Sarah.
Edward, there's like 30 seconds when Edward isn't going, sorry, in what case? This is the defining decision of this entire meal, and you're about to make it, and now you're sitting there like you're in The Mirror Cracked, and you've just seen the woman who gave you...
Don't spoil the mirror cracked. But I think she answers him with just a Jan twinkle. Like, just something... She knows how to change her body language, just slightly to say, go on then, you naughty man.
Not the kind of Jan twinkle he's after.
I know it's not, and he's not going to get the actual one. I mean, he just can't do.
So back to Ken's cuckoldry.
Yes.
Sarah's quite boring, yes?
She's very beautiful and very dull. She's just sort of, again, sort of blown along like a leaf in the wind when it comes to Ken. She's always going, oh, I feel really guilty, and then getting off with him. Just, you know.
Yeah, and he absolutely exploits that, because whole scene is kiss, 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 I'd better go, don't go, okay, kiss, 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 but I should go, but kiss, but go, but kiss, but go.
Yes. Yeah, so he's massively manipulating her, and she wonders why Ken's wanting to go, and actually she senses that it might be the fact he's seen Jan. Jan's the only woman he's ever actually loved and kind of relaxed with. So is the only woman he hasn't just treated like an object. He's actually sort of invested emotionally in her. So it probably did ruffle his feathers
a bit.
And
financially.
Well, yes, and still financially. He's not willing to let go of that, obviously, because the feelings are still there. And then we leave Sarah alone looking at a picture of her cuckolded, dickless husband. Fade. And then we go to the Howard's house, where Jan is trying to sneak in from her date with Sir Edward, like closing the door very
gently.
Silver
teapot or stainless steel teapot?
It's a stainless steel teapot, I think. We do see Kate doing the silver in the last episode, but that looks too modern to be a... Well, it could be.
Now, this is a scene which was written in Romanian or Bulgarian and translated into English by somebody who's not great at either language.
Okay.
Particularly when Jan says, just like the old times.
Yeah, and that was a bit odd, wasn't it? Just like old times or the olden days or but not the olden
times. Just like the old times in my village.
It's a little strange. But Kate warns her daughter, obviously after what happened to Lynn with Freya Jr., so just be careful. He looks like an extremely attractive man, but, you know, he might be like father, like son, like son, like father.
And the Freya confusion is all over this thing. Pick a side.
I asked Jan, she's like, no, it was never decided. There was no style guide on that. Everyone just made up their own pronunciation.
That's perfect. Well, everyone really does. And I think what's confusing is sometimes people are saying Freya, but they're so posh it comes out as Freya. So you don't actually know. You don't actually know whether they're doing doubly or... Anyway.
Yes, very confusing.
Then there's... I know the legal scene is really important, but it's quite dark.
It's a bit... Brown wood panelling has been shipped in at the last minute. And they're arguing in a solicitor's office about the main beam again. Like, we don't really need to see this gone over again. It never seems to move things on either. It's like another meeting to establish that Tom is still in limbo, his reputation still hangs in the balance, da 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 da, etc. etc.
But crucially, they won't accept a settlement, will they? So no. Tom's going to be bankrupt.
If this now goes against him, which it looks like it could do, then yes, the yard, everything gone, fut. Awful. Obviously, so it then triggers a massive boozing bender with Tom and Jack later on in The Jolly Sailor, where we'll find them in a minute. Oh. Back at Highfield, which is the grand ancestral seat of the Freya family.
There's some very ill advised handheld in the car.
Yes, and also
it gave me motion sickness. It was like zooming all around with the Baroque music.
Someone
like,
is sitting in the passenger seat of Jan's VW, I think, and it's a little bit little bit Lars von Trier's. but there's harpsichord and birdsong, it establishes baronial rural idyll. And she's late.
I thought she was listening to the Baroque music, but then in the car. But then
no, there's just always a string quartet and a harpsichord playing that outside his house, you know, just to let people know that this is the kind of...
She's in virginal white. She's saying, "Don't touch me."
She is,
and she is late. She's sending messages there.
And do you know why she's late, John? She's late because she had another meeting at the bank. She has one about twice a day at the moment. I had a meeting at the bank. I just couldn't get away. Again, all you do, don't you? Having an affair with the bank manager. Just say it. Yes, so then we go to the Herbert's house.
I assumed that Gerald was in the middle of someone, and that's why he was not where he was supposed
to be. Well, I knew that
maybe
he wasn't.
Because of
the hidden sadness, John, that he can't speak out loud. But so, yes, we're actually at the Urquhart's house and Polly answers the phone. I've put here, in frightful plaid, to Charles, who was calling to inquire after the whereabouts of Gerald, who it turns out has gone AWOL. And she's like, oh no, there's been an accident, because he pays the credit card bills. And then we do go back to Highfield, where they're in the sunny garden and they're kind of at Jan and Sir Edward are having this dancing around each other conversation about, you know, oh, don't you get lonely in this big house? Bearing in mind she's there because she's like, you own that big house, don't you? Can I have a look round? I like your house. It's massive. She's got designs on it.
It's Jan and Ed do sexual politics again.
Yeah.
Because
the role of women in the workplace, etc., etc.
He says he's only happy when he's working.
Yeah.
And that's the wrong way round because it's the least important. And he's like, tell that to everyone in the arts. And she says, what about Mrs. Everyone in the arts?
Yes, Mrs. Shakespeare.
Well, she creates subsets. Mrs. Shakespeare wouldn't say so, nor would most women. So we've got Mrs. Shakespeare and most women in different... I suppose most women aren't Mrs. Shakespeare, so Jan's maths is flawless.
But then she goes on to say, because she's still trying to keep him at arm's length romantically, that all she has time for is work, and she just doesn't have anything else to do. It's like, okay.
Walking, by the way, to her car, they're standing on a sort of nice balcony. There's no, I'd better go. They're chatting away. Mrs. Shakespeare this, Mrs. Shakespeare that. And she's just grudging. I seem to be getting closer and closer to my car. and basically, she said, when she gets to the I'm not available line, she puts her hand on her car door.
Yeah.
White dress, you see. And then, even as she's left without any kind of salutation, no, I'd better go. She's literally...
No.
And he says, through the window... I'm going to be talking to the people with the money you want about the money you want tomorrow.
And he's really leaning through the window as well.
And she says, all right, bye.
Not like, I better slip me the tongue then just to make sure I've sealed the deal.
No, but not even a... Well, that's very kind of you. Fingers crossed, thank you for lunch.
This is strange, isn't it?
All right, bye.
Scenes oddly this series. Then we go to the boat where Leo is finishing painting it. He's removing the masking tape from a painting job he's been doing. He's magically got clients for his boat painting business. He handed out the flyers yesterday. Today, can't move for clients. He's got so many.
And Amanda is also wearing a beach hat. That's a theme of the episode. Exactly. She's wearing a blue beach hat that matches Dulcie's yellow one.
A lot of lovely stripes.
This is where maybe I start sort of losing sympathy with her. She essentially says, you know how me having money makes you uncomfortable? Do you want some of my money?
Because then you'd have some and I'd have some, so it'd like be more evens.
It's, I want to invest in you. Oh, don't do anything, I'm Leo. I mean, why isn't he saying the rainforests? Why isn't he saying the whales?
Yes, what about all the ecology he was so wrapped
up in? What actually happens in this scene, never mind what you say about Amanda stealing boats or whatever, is she says, would you like some money? And he says, yeah, and kisses her.
He does. That's, like mother,
that's
like
what
son,
happens.
Right? Yeah. Again, his conviction is never obvious. He doesn't jump into anything with both feet. He just goes, well, if I stand here long enough, you'll probably, gravity will just mean we'll end up banging our faces together. He's just so unenthusiastic. It's very, very strange. And also, while he's kissing her, he then sort of goes to put his arm round her, but just ends up staring at the paint on the back of his own hand while he's kissing
which
her.
Which looks like a wound.
It's just weird. There's some kissing, at least. That's nice. There's a bit more flirtation in this episode. The last couple of episodes, John, it was just briefcases and, oh my God, boardrooms. This is so much more exciting. So back at the Urquharts, Gerald does finally turn up and he says he's been visiting a friend.
His very best friend, we discover.
His oldest and dearest friend.
And it's all about what's unspoken between them. Polly says the single most creepy thing anyone could say in that situation.
I was about to say it was really tender and really lovely.
So my oldest friend is dying. I've just seen him nearly on the verge of dying. I'm very upset about it. I'm invested enough about this to lie to you about it.
Yeah.
Share him with me, says Polly.
She's just like, I haven't got anything to do. I'm bored. Tell me about the shit that's going on in your life, please.
I want to suckle on your grief. I want to drink your pain.
I want to consume it.
I want to turn from a stick into a real girl.
I read it entirely as like I was sympathetic to her, that she's been trying to get him to open up to her. But maybe her...
Totally creeped out.
Maybe her motivation is a bit not great. But I just thought it was her trying to
show tenderness. It's like that song from The Phantom of the Opera. Say your share with me each day, each morning. Anywhere you go, let me go too. Love me. That's all I ask of you, it's called. Let me go everywhere you go.
Yeah.
That is all I ask.
It's like
that's the vibe I got from Share Him With Me.
Now we go on to The Jolly Sailor, where Jack and Tom are arseholed. And then there's the
most...
As you
can tell from all the completely empty glasses in front of them.
Empty glasses.
They are just... But there's not a dribble in them.
No, well, they're very
They've
sad.
They've just been put there.
And then now onto the tiny glasses of whiskey that they'll be able to down in two gulps. And then there's the most awkward thing I've ever seen, I think, in an episode of Howard's Way, where Jack's drunk, he calls the pub to order in order to say something important to the gathered drinkers. But it doesn't really go to plan.
It's brilliantly awkward. I felt really uncomfortable. I stopped writing notes. They first of all sort of totally ignore him. Then he tries to get them to sing for He's a Jolly Good Fellow.
Yeah.
And the nearest extra to him does the classic, who's this guy thumb?
Yeah.
You know, the thumb pointing behind you. Eventually, he just bullies them into finishing He's a Jolly Good Fellow. And then he says, hip, hip, hooray. And all the various sex criminals that are gathered around the bar, who all have sex criminal coats and sex criminal glasses on, do a sort of half-hearted sex criminal hooray.
But then and even the hoorays are so puny. It's just, I wish he hadn't bothered. Then we go to sea. Powerboats. They're lining up for the big race. Charles has got binoculars. There's adrenaline in the air. Avril's there. Sarah's there. And she wishes Ken and Mark good luck in turn, but obviously is caught between the two of them. And they're now in direct competition.
Can I read you my notes verbatim?
Please.
Capital letters, drama boat, exclamation mark. No idea. Avril, question mark? Is this the race, question mark? It must be the race. Synth and sax. Gave up on knowing what's happening.
Cool. Excellent. So that's all you need to know. There's going to be a race. There's synth. There's sax. It's power. It's the 80s. It's exciting. They're revving their engines. Cut to...
my favourite mini scene in the whole episode.
This
and I'll tell you why.
Fashion HQ.
First of all, Jan comes into shot from about 15 feet away. So they're doing the Akon Antiques. Yes, that's much better if we take delivery of these antiques in the morning, etc. But for some reason, Jan is too far off camera. So you see her sort of bombing in, going, peplums, slacks, on the bias. And then
no, she has a brilliant line. Can we not? Can I have written the line down because I liked it so much. She says, yes, I see. Yes, I see what you mean about the sleeve length, but isn't it going to elongate the shoulder line? And Anna reassures her that that's all been accounted for in other parts of the design. But I love it when they try and do fashion talk, business talk, boaty talk is my favourite, obviously, because they just get it straight out of a textbook. And it's hot. But the fashion talk is like the second best thing. Then Edward shows up. Again, people, just men not getting the message and just turning up, or women not getting the message and just turning up. Basically, Don't Stand So Close to Me by the Police, isn't it? No, it's Every Breath You Take by the Police.
It's both.
Everyone's stalking everyone else.
It's a Police Greatest Hits album episode.
It literally is. So Edward shows up to
Leo,
tell...
Invisible Sun.
Hey! Honestly, if you've got any more Police Howard's Way mashups, we'd love to hear them. Please write in and say.
Edward... I love the end of this scene.
Oh, go on. Okay.
Sorry, go on.
No, I'm saying Edward turns up to tell her in person the good news that she's now going to get the grant, get all the money, she can open a boutique, all that business. Yeah.
And we see the most Howard's Way thing ever, which is... Jan opens the envelope, which presumably is the cheque.
Yeah, I wanted it to be a big cheque. I was sad it wasn't like a really big cheque.
She shows it sort of reverentially to Anna, and it's like, money. Look, it's money.
It's what we all dream of.
Look at the piece of paper that says money.
This is what it's all
that's
about.
That's how it's way. I can do the next scene for you again from my notes.
That would be great. So back at the powerboat race.
Race! Exclamation mark. I am checking Twitter. I started checking Twitter.
Oh, John.
People with binoculars are happy or worried. I think Ken won, which for some reason is bad for Avril.
That's the scene. See, so again, you got all the salient points there. Leisure Cruise had two riders in that race, Ken and Mark. Obviously, competition for Sarah's love, competition for male supremacy generally. Ken beats professional speedboat racer Mark somehow. He beats him, so Ken is delighted. Mark can be seen to be annoyed because he's kind of shaking his fists in the air, but from a very long way away, but you need to see that he's pissed off.
It's also important to be able to recognise Mark from a long way away, isn't it, Julia?
Oh, it will be. You know it. Then we cut to Sarah, who's delighted. She's like, oh, we've got first and second, because, you know, both the men she's sleeping with did very well. And then the Scotsman, you probably won't know, is standing next to her, is like a new client of Leisure Cruise, and his boats are the ones that have just won the race. And she's like, that's great, they've both won. And she's like, he's got a couple of great pilots there. Then you can hold on to both of them for the rest of the season. And Sarah's face clouds and I kind of like, oh shit, yeah, hold on to both
hold
of them.
Hold on to both their dicks, more like.
Well, I mean, that's effectively what she is doing. So we leave her there in her own sort of moral quandary, but not really. And then we go to the back of Sir Edward's sort of chauffeur-driven limousine where he's with Sir John.
He's driving through his wooded area.
He just gets to drive around the estate.
Where the women who don't get investment end up.
That's right, with the dogs chasing them. he says again, this is about the fifth time he said to Sir John, his faithful elderly retainer, this is the bank guy, he says to him, have you severed all connections with Charles yet? Because we've now established that Charles and Edward are going to go up against each other in business. They're in competition now. One wants to destroy the other. And Sir John sort of advises Charles, and now Edward's back from abroad. He's like, you're going to have to stop doing that because we're in competition now. It's a conflict of interest. So Sir John is not getting the message. Have you severed contact with Charles yet? No.
They're the original Charles and Eddie of Would I Lie to You?
Yes, they are. Charles and Eddie, as they shall now be known. Brilliant. So that situation is unresolved, but it's, he seems
Speaking
to
Speaking of Charles, he has, as we find out in the next scene, the uncanny ability to sound totally amplified in a large pub garden without a microphone in sight. We do a tracking shot in of the pub. There's 200 people in the garden. There's a big sign up saying Ken has won the race. He gets the money.
It does
now,
say that,
or
yeah,
something.
Yeah.
And then he does a ladies and gentlemen, and you've got the sound echoing off the walls and bouncing. And I was thinking, please don't let there be a microphone in front of him. That would make my day. And then they cut to him and he's doing it all with projection, love.
Wow.
He isn't. He was mic'd.
No, come on. I can't believe that. He's a trained actor. He was doing it just all with the power of his own voice. So yes, it's the prize giving. Ken has won the race. He's in receipt of a £10,000 check and a medium-sized cup into which obviously he pours champagne. Ken is resplendent in a very vivid lemon racing suit.
Oh, Ken, that's a lot of yellow.
He does look
that's
pretty. I think he carries it off pretty well.
If anyone can, Masters can.
Yeah, and he's smugging his own face off. He's loving himself sick. And he smarms at Charles, who he's had run-ins with in the past, and says, better luck next time, eh? And Charles, you know, sucks lemons, ironically, while Ken is wearing them. And then we go to the Admiral's house.
Oh, Michael, that voice. Michael Denison, real-life husband of Dulcie Gray.
Yay!
Playing her old love interest with a twinkle and a sort of molasses-coloured rich voice, which is the poshest thing you have ever heard in your life.
And it's so lovely.
He says, damn the begonias.
Damn the begonias. So Kate
turns
up.
So she's come to sex some money out of him.
She's going to share. Until he agrees to have his boat built by her other friend, Jack, who she's not having any kind of romantic thing with. They're just pals. But this is clearly an old flame from 30 or more years ago. They dance cheek to cheek and then he sings to her, Moonlight Becomes You. And it's all very like, oh, you lovely old, stop it. No, don't stop it. It's lovely. And they kind of have this lovely sort of reunion. It's delightful. And she advises him on the planting of his begonias. They're in the wrong place. There's too much shade there and they need more sun, apparently. Or is it they need
Damn
more shade?
Damn the begonias.
Of... Yeah. Anyway.
There's another classic sexy line that they both laugh at along the lines of, don't tell the sex equality people. He says, I don't like bossy women. And she laughs a merry laugh.
But so real life husband and wife, I'm guessing it just became, he became free and she was like, solid, do you want to?
Come and do this.
Yeah. Like, it feels like a part that was written for him. He is just perfection.
Oh, gotcha.
And I'm pleased to report there will be more. It's not like a one episode thing. He's joining the show for a while. And maybe there's a little something going on with the two of them.
Oh, lordy. I also love the way the series three is very happy to go, here's the Morris Traveller. You know that means Dulcie.
Oh, I know. I haven't seen that car for ages. It's my favourite car. I still long for that car.
So now we're back in cuckold land and Tote Leisure Wear is a bad loser. And they're drinking champagne from the cup and sort of talking about the future. And there's lots of references to them being a team, which is full of irony. But then another classic of business speak. Absolutely one of my favourite moments of, well, just say something that sounds like job stuff, where essentially Ken says, why don't we get someone to invest money in the business? And Sarah says, yes, and then we could use the money they give us to buy things.
It is marvellously like Fisher-Price. Yeah, it's not good, is it?
That is brilliant.
Although
brilliant business.
To add to your Charles Freer pronunciation dossier, in this scene, Ken says, and I quote, you should have seen Charles Freer's face. Freer's face. It was,
very interesting.
It was, again, like, I thought there were no new ways to go. He found a new one. It was just astonishing.
He says, well, I'm going to go to Portugal, as if to say, I'm going to punch you in the face.
Exactly. I think he says it aggressively because what he really means is, I'm going to hide behind a bush to see if you're cheating on my wife.
As we all discover.
Yes, exactly. So then we go to the yard where Tom is forlornly packing a cardboard box with his things because he's going to throw himself on his sword and just leave the yard, just walk off into the desert on his own, probably just die.
They talk him out of it. They say, how will the court case look if you've left the yard? It'll look guilty. They all have these good reasons why Tom should stay put and stop sulking.
Exactly.
But then they come up with the most time-intensive, useless Heath Robinson plan, which is essentially boiled down to, hang on, why don't I rebuild the boat and see if I make the same mistake again, and then I'll know what mistake I made if I did.
They can't get the actual boat, so they're just going to have to make a new one, but surely that'll take ages.
And also, you can't come into court and go, here's a boat I've made well, and the court will go, mate, it's not the one the woman drowned in.
Yeah, no, that is a different one. That guy, yeah, no, it's
what you what you've done is you've made that again, haven't you? Gavel,
I don't
gavel.
Think that ultimately is going to be what clears him, if indeed he does get cleared. But at the end of the scene is a really nice little moment of like proper cheesecake sort of Hollywood, where Kate's standing in the middle. She's announced that she's persuaded the Admiral to throw his money their way. He is going to order a boat. She's managed to convince him to commit. And Tom's on one side, Jack's on the other. And they just basically, hooray for Kate. And they both kind of lean in and kiss her on the cheek at the same time. Mm. It's just, it's delightful. And then she says,
Kate Wilder, she used to be called.
She says, you should have seen me when I was Kate Wilder. And, you know, and knowing what we know about the real Dulcie as well, she really was. She had a good time on this earth.
Yeah. Also, that's, I think Kate Wilder is now going to be my drag name.
Absolutely should be. I was thinking about using it in my book, actually. I go, well, you have it. It's fine. It's fine. Okay. So then one more time back to the speed. So the speedboats have been quite a phallic thing in this episode. But now they really are because Ken's on a speedboat moored offshore with Sarah.
In the tiniest shorts.
And she's in a blue bikini to denote whore.
Yeah.
As I wrote, is your code. Yeah.
When I saw the shorts, I wrote, please, Ken, my children, they're very young. You can't suddenly show us these teeny tiny shorts. And then we really, really do get massive foreshadowing in this one because Ken says, are you sure he caught that plane? And Sarah says, yes, I saw him through the departure channel myself, which is another piece
which
of Bulgarian
translation.
Which
means he had to do the Chandler thing to get rid of Janice, if we're bringing it back to her again, where he had to literally almost fly to Yemen because he told her he was
Yemen
going
Street,
to Yemen.
So in the knowledge that Mark is safely through the departure channel, yeah. Ken and Sarah think, well, let's do it right here, just under this handy viewing area.
Yes, in sight of
let's
the shore.
Let's put the boat right under that promontory where Mark likes to stand with his binoculars.
Sure
Can't
enough.
See anything would go wrong there.
Sure enough, they start smooching and sipping on champagne and generally being half nude together. And meanwhile, behind a hedge, Mark the cuckold with his binoculars hovers, positions himself and looks through his viewfinders and sees what he needs to see, basically. And then Sarah senses something isn't quite right and looks and sees him.
She probably sees movement 3 feet away, which is where where he's standing. They are under him.
It was a mistake in hindsight, John. But yes, and her face, you know, goes all sort of thundercloudy. And Ken says, was that who I thought it was? And she nods and he says, oh, dear. Titles. So at the end of episode, obviously very bad things are coming in terms of that little love triangle. How did you feel after your third visit to Tarrant?
I'm quite scared at what will have changed by the time in episode four.
Mm.
As ever, a mixture of baffled, relieved and grateful that in the course of an episode, it is possible to catch up. So I was up to speed with what's happening in the plot by
you
the end of the
see,
episode.
This is the beauty of the show.
And just very much enjoying, if that's the right word, what this show thinks human beings are, which are walking, can I have some money or sex or food machines?
Look,
which I suppose we might be.
These are the 80s, John. Like, to be honest, now it seems like it does seem like a more innocent time. Compared to now, it's like it's the only place I want to live.
I think if it continues on this trajectory, everyone in the show rolling around the floor of Casper's in fashion wear, having sex and eating money.
Drinking crude oil from goblets. Sex,
then,
business, oil.
Then suddenly, somebody will be freezing in a fluorescent gilet on a boat for 20 seconds. So hang on, but that surely means the thing about the boats is going to happen to the boats, and then we'll cut back to the orgy. That has to be the direction they're heading in.
It was such a pleasure to have you back in, Taryn. I believe you're going to have a stab at the closing song, is that correct?
I am, yes.
It's not about Leo being a serial killer, is it? Because it just seems to be a theme.
It's not. Well, no, I've gone off the serial killer thing now. I just think he's maybe not human. Or maybe the inter. I think Leo's going to end up doing Gamergate or something like that.
Fine. Yeah, actually, for after today's episode, that does seem more likely. Anyway, John, I can't wait to hear your song, Warm Up Your Pipes, and thank you again for being always there.
Thank you very much. I hope I always will.
Friend or friend, the answer's so unclear, so much that most of the cast are clueless too. Are they saying it real or threat? Each time it reappears, it's different, so I beg you, please decide real or threat.
Face those Twitter notifications? Forgot to watch anything but Netflix? Dreading the video conference small talk at 9? You need a news vitamin, you know. You need the Smart 7. It's a brand new daily podcast that puts your brain into gear. Everything you need to know in less than 7 minutes. You need the smarts? Hey, we got the smarts. The Smart 7, every weekday at 7 a.m. Available right now on Spotify and all the usual places.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.